Hello and welcome to Sip for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. We're back for the second of our more regular episodes. Last week, we heard Sip for CEO Rob Whiteman's reflections on the impact of COVID-19 on the public sector. This week, we were joined by Breaking Barriers Innovations to explore the benefits of a place-based approach in local government and the importance of investing in prevention. I'm here with Nick Warren and Dr. John Bashford from Breaking Barriers Innovations. So thank you both for being with us today. We'll kick off with Nick, who is the CEO of Breaking Barriers. So Nick, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself, your background and how you came to be involved with Breaking Barriers?
Hi, Ashley. Just a correction, because we don't have a CEO at Breaking Barriers. I'm actually the partnership director. Just a bit about myself, if you are interested. I'm sure you're not, but I began my career in the early 2000s. I found myself after university doing events for government all around public sector reform. But I found myself increasingly being drawn to actually the reports and the market intelligence which informed our events. At the beginning of 2010, I set up Dragongate Market Intelligence. We set up Dragongate because we wanted to look at what were the real issues facing government. One of the projects which we did involved the city of Bradford, where they were looking to develop a vision for Bradford around health and social care. And that's where I first encountered Dr. John Bashford and Lord Patella Bradford, who's the chairman at Breaking Barriers. And that's how we started off.
Great. Thank you, Nick. And as you said, we have Dr. John Bashford with us here as well, who is Breaking Barriers Research Programme Director. So, John, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved with Breaking Barriers?
Hi, yes. I'm actually a registered mental nurse by background, and I've been a director and a non-exec director in different NHS trusts. I also worked for a number of years with Lord Patel of Bradford in academia, where we set up and ran the Centre for Ethnicity and Health at the University of Central Lancashire in Preston. And a lot of that work was around community engagement, equality and human rights. For the last few years before Breaking Barriers, I was working quite a bit on population health needs assessments, working in the criminal justice sector. So I've always really been involved around areas to do with health, particularly mental health and well-being and social determinants of health.
So, Nick, can you tell us a bit more about Breaking Barriers? So as an organisation, what are you all about?
We set up Breaking Barriers because I'd seen a lot of talk about people moving into a place-based approach in public services. I think what we all agree on in terms of when we set up Breaking Barriers is that there's a bit of a paradox going on here. Most people in the public sector do think that a place-based approach is a very sensible thing to do, because it enables us to get to the real causes of poor health. It's not just health, it's all forms of public service. If you're looking at criminal justice, education, there's lots of things which we need to do which we're not allowed to because of the original structures we inherit. So everyone gets that as a principle, but ironically or paradoxically, the way we approach it is through a very top-down lens. And the thing is, because it's such a radical thing which we need to do in terms of moving into this place-based approach, those artificial top-down structures don't really work. What we've done at Breaking Barriers, we think that we need to move this agenda on. And I think, number one, we need to work with public service leaders and convince them that not only is this the nice thing to do or the right thing to do, but there's actually a business case behind it. People struggle with that. They think that there's always a better time to do this. There's never a good time to do these things. So we started Breaking Barriers to sort of tackle that. So what we came up with is a thing which we're doing all around the country now, which is called the Playbook for Place. It begins with strategic alignment. And the idea there, firstly, talking to the system leaders and getting their opinions about, if you could change one thing, what do you all agree that if we don't work on this single thing together, we're all going to fail? So we identified that. It's called the dominant strategy, which actually comes from game theory. And what that means is funneling out all the options, which, you know, there might be a downside there, and just focusing upon the real win-win-wins. And we look at the statistical evidence out there, and we look at what the actual problems are, and then we actually give this single challenge. And the reason we do that is, if we try to do everything at once, we'll never do anything. But if we can identify one big challenge, which we can all agree across the system, but if we all work together on that, there's a clear benefit. We can all sell this into our organisations. A, it means there's a focus and a rationale. Secondly, it means that it's quite easy for people to start getting on with it because there's one single challenge. And thirdly, instead of creating new things and new strategies and new plans, they can actually focus on their existing projects into that one single challenge. So once we've done that, the rest of it is just talking to people. We talk to residents and say, okay, here's a plan. How can we make this better? We talk to the workforce, because if you don't get the workforce on side on this, they're going to be the people who are actually going to be asking questions when we come up with a strategy. Why are we doing this? Does this mean more work for the same pay? Does this actually stop me from doing the job which I was trained to do in the first place? What support do I need? And at the end of this, instead of coming up with a report or a strategy, we're coming up with a set of actions. And some of those actions might be quite big and require investment. A lot of the actions are actually just pointing in a lot of complementary but potentially duplicated strategies into the same single coherent goal. So that's what we're doing. And we've had some great support from government upon this. Health Education England are looking at this project from a perspective of their people plan and seeing what this what place means for the NHS requirements. We're also working in Portsmouth, which I think John will talk more about, because that's about we're looking at social isolation. That's the work which we're potentially going to be doing some stuff with SIPFA on.
I mean, I came up through the public sector through a local government graduate programme, and this was a couple of years ago now, but even then they were talking about working in a more place-based way. And when we talk about place, as you say, it's still something that's fairly new, and particularly to citizens, it could be something that they don't fully understand. What do you mean by working in a place-based way? There are clear benefits to the organisation, but what are the benefits to me as a citizen? How would you define place-based working for a citizen in a place?
One of the viewpoints, if I can put it that way, from government is a place-based approach could be a STP, so a Sustainable Transformation Plan, or it could be a LEP, a Local Enterprise Partnership. What those things are systems. They're very, very good. They're geographical, but they are systems. They are ways of marshalling places from point A to point B. When you're talking about place, in terms of what making it a meaningful thing, it's got to be something which they can actually recognise. It's got to be a pub or a club or a street or a neighbourhood. If you move beyond that sense of scale, so you can do both things, but you can't confuse them equally. It's got to be something which people can recognise, because if it's not that, then we're confusing people.
It's actually a really good question and very key to Portsmouth. As Nick was explaining, I think health, local government tend to think much more in systems, and they might call those places, but they're not. And for me as a local resident, for you as a local resident, it's immediately where we live. It's the streets surrounding us. It's the neighbourhood. Have I got local shops and amenities? Is there a sports club nearby? Where can I actually go out and walk the dog? Who do I meet people with in my local environment? That's the place. And it's incredibly local. It really is about my immediate area. It's hard for big public sector systems to think in such small ways. There are economies of scale that make it seem easier to think bigger. I mean, Portsmouth was a really interesting place to look at social isolation, because it's actually the most highly dense city population-wise outside London. We tend, I think, to think much more, or pre-COVID, I think people thought much more when they thought about social isolation and loneliness. They thought about older people living on their own or rural communities. But of course, you can be incredibly lonely and isolated in the most densely populated city environment. And it is right across the life course. So this is not something that just affects the elderly. And I think COVID has really brought this home to a lot more people, that it's incredibly difficult if you are isolated.
So you've both touched on the work that's been going on in Portsmouth. So, John, you've been involved with kind of the methodology and the research that's been going on there. So could you go into a bit more detail on what that work has actually entailed?
We were approached by the community trust there, Solent NHS Trust, who were very keen to get their head about the playbook programme, and they thought it would be a really good thing to do in Portsmouth. And we were keen to work in Portsmouth. The local authority, the clinical commissioning group and the community trust operate in a very, very close way. They have joint posts appointed across them. They have a lot of staff who are co-located in the same buildings, and a long history of working together. So for a place-based approach, it felt like a lot of the ingredients were in that. And they wanted to look at social isolation and loneliness, because it wasn't something they'd actually put a great deal of focus into. But at the same time, they are a sort of vanguard city for working family-first approaches and restorative practices and working more with how you get individuals to be responsible for their own healthcare and well-being and interact more. And they thought social isolation and loneliness across the life course would be a really important thing to think about, and especially from a workforce perspective. So if we work with a problem like this, what does it actually mean for your health visitors, for your nurses, for your social workers, and for your care staff? So we interviewed a lot of frontline staff, not just from health and social services, but community and voluntary sector workers as well. And we did some focus groups and some interviews with local residents and service users to get their perspectives. And there were six sort of key learning things that came out from that earlier set of interviews. Firstly, we need to get better at identifying who's at risk. So as I said, everyone has a general awareness about elderly people living on their own, but we don't tend to think in terms of risks for other groups. And the health harms of this are really significant. Being lonely, research evidence has showed, is actually very similar to health harms of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Also, access to local services is crucial for this. If we're going to be able to address people's social isolation and loneliness, then they've really got to have local things within their reach that they can participate in, where they can meet people. But one of the impacts from austerity over the last 10 years is that services have contracted. So a lot of things have been shrunk and brought or concentrated and brought more into city centres. But going back to where we started with what place means and how local and immediate that is, actually, if you live in the north of Portsmouth, travelling to the city centre was a huge obstacle. There were practical issues. It was costly on public transport. It could take up to 2 hours on a bus to get into the city centre. So just to go and attend something there could take out a whole day of someone's time. They weren't necessarily able to afford it. But perhaps more importantly, culturally, people didn't identify so much with the city centre. What they really needed was local things, and a lot of those have been withdrawn. Also, being able to get to people at earlier points on this issue is really crucial. So people tend to approach a service when they're already in crisis and a lot of damage has been done. Some of those harms might have started when perhaps they first started becoming isolated or lonely, but then it compounds with lots of other problems. And by the time someone's actually appeared in a service, it's a really complex problem to unravel. So we need to be able to pick up and recognise problems at a much earlier point and put in things that help people. And so fundamentally, the last thing we learned there was you can't do any of this without working with communities themselves. They hold the key and the answer. So a service response on its own would never be enough. One of the ways we identify to think about this is we're actually quite good at putting services in. We give people befriending services. A very common thing at the moment is people talk a lot about social prescribing, where they're perhaps introduced to a friendship network or a day centre or some kind of community activity. These things are all important, but in some respects, they're like sticking plasters. And what the evidence says is really effective are those things that help us naturally develop and sustain our social connections. We took all of that and developed an action plan. And although there is a report on this work, which people can access from the Breaking Barriers website, or they will be able to do shortly, it isn't about the report, it's about an action plan. And I won't go into all the details of the action plan, but it falls into sort of three broad categories. First, to be aware. So right across the board, not just with your professional staff, but with librarians, with heritage people, with volunteers, and with communities themselves. And having done that, it's not just enough to be aware. We've actually got to recognise the problems. So thinking again in what I said in terms of risk profiles for people. So who is most at risk? Which people are actually more vulnerable than others? And what are the factors that affect and surround that? As a kind of side piece from this, the Ministry for Communities and Local Government heard about the work. Each government department at the moment is tasked with having a strategy for loneliness. And a lot of that came out after the Joe Cox Commission was formed, and they really raised the profile for this generally. And we have a minister for loneliness. And so they were keen to get involved with the Portsmouth piece. And we did some additional work, tying in what we'd been doing with workforce learning and practitioners and communities with thinking about all of the infrastructure of a place. And that became the third part of our plank in the action plan, which is about responding. So it's be aware, recognize, and then respond. And we have to do this across a range of measures, from having much more informed levels of case management and skills and competencies amongst workers. So actually being able to motivate people, you can suggest to someone that there's a day centre down the road or a club they could get involved in. It's not easy sometimes for people to actually walk in that building or overcome those hurdles. You have to really be able to work with people at a motivational level to get them to think differently about the value of social connection. Everything needs to be done with the community and voluntary sector and with faith communities as well. They have always led the way in terms of social prescribing and working with communities and having better access and early help. And they're fundamental in this area as well. And one of the latter things we've done with the action plan is try and take learning from COVID. So as I say, there's been some positives there, I think, in people being more aware of how harmful this issue can be. But we need to make sure some of the good things of that are sustainable. So some people who were isolated during COVID have had volunteers going in, perhaps taking them food, doing their shopping. But being isolated was never on its own a factor that would put you in a vulnerability category or in the shield, as it was. And as we move out of COVID and start to think more about restoration and recovery, we've got to be careful we don't suddenly drop some of these good things that have been happening. How do we sustain them? How do we keep that community involvement, and how do we continue to recognise vulnerability of people? So we've built in some additional actions, thinking about COVID and any possible future similar crisis situation that might happen, and how local authorities and health systems can be better prepared for that.
That sounds really interesting. Within some of that, you touched on the idea of early intervention and the importance of that in preventing problems from kind of spiralling and getting worse down the line and more complex to unpick. So many of our listeners will know that last year SIPFA released a piece of work with Public Health England around evaluating investment in prevention. And I know the work you're doing in Portsmouth has then bounced on to some work that you're doing around piloting the work from that initial publication. Is there anything you can tell me about kind of where that work has got to?
Yeah, so we're in an early stage of this. On the positive side, there's been a real enthusiasm locally to engage with this. I think we've always known, as the SIPFA framework points out, that prevention is better than cure. But making that happen is really, really hard. We've got this cross-sector flow problem. So where you want people to spend money, they don't necessarily aren't the organisation that gets the benefits back again. It might be to a different part of the system. So it's a real kind of sovereignty hurdle to get people over. But that's why we believe so strongly in a place-based approach, because if you can stop thinking about the professional identity or the organizational identity, then we can actually, it won't matter where those benefits are going in terms of a single entity, because it's a benefit for the place as a whole. And social isolation is a great one to look at this, because the cost implications of this are actually quite clear, and there's a good evidence base to support them. So for instance, social care costs alone from social isolation across the country, we're looking at around 1 billion in costs to the NHS in terms of GP visits, in terms of practice nurse visits, and then prescribing, because these people also tend to be on more drugs. So we've begun to talk to finance directors in the community trust about how we can start to reframe some of this, and we're then hoping to widen that out into engagements with public health directors and for different local organisations, and eventually up to the SDP level, to really change the conversation. And all of this is key to the NHS long-term plan. It won't work, and it won't be affordable or sustainable if we actually don't do this shift. And we think that with the work in Portsmouth, we've got a good body of stuff to start with, we've got the action plan, we've got a clear evidence base around some of these costs, that we can really begin to change the nature of the conversation.
So to conclude, and I suppose to Nick, to bring you back into the conversation, you've talked a lot about how place is such a local thing, and that's the level at which it needs to be implemented. But if we kind of bring this up to the macro level, what would you say there is to learn from the work you've been doing for the wider public sector?
I think the bulk of our work is about forms of trade-off. At the moment, we're looking at trade-offs between the economy and health. I think what our work is hoping to prove is that actually they're not trade-offs at all. They're actually part of a same overall strategy. Instead of looking at trade-offs from breaking barriers, I think there are some things which local areas, they might think that they've got competing agendas, but there's some things which those competing agendas have in common. I think that's really important if you're going to do a place-based approach. You've got to identify what those commonalities are. I think the second thing to mention is around, you know, again, going back to systems and places. We can't think of the place-based approach to health and social care or local government being around STPs. We've got to really, really understand what place means. And I think thirdly, I think the workforce is largely uncharted territory in terms of place. We've always taken them for granted. We've always assumed if we make decisions up here at the chief executive or director level, that's how we're going to get this started. We need to bring in the workforce at a very, very early stage, like the beginning. Because if we don't do that, they will just feel that it's actually not something which is going to be useful for their jobs, which might involve saving lives or providing someone with some very, very important form of social care. If we were to think 10 years hence and think, okay, if we're going to solve this health challenge, what sort of jobs and roles do we need, which we don't have at the moment? And we were to work back to that all the way back from 10 years to today, we would end up making decisions right now, which are very, very different from the ones we're making at the moment.
John, did you have anything further to add?
We have a real risk at the moment, potentially facing a very severe economic downturn, that as in the last one, the answer was all about disinvestment. And we can't underplay the implications of those disinvestment decisions when it comes to issues like health and wellbeing, and particularly thinking about social isolation and loneliness. So the argument for really moving upscale in terms of the SIPA framework for a new way of thinking about prevention and the cost as an investment is really, really crucial. This isn't about making cash flow savings in the short term. This is fundamentally about demand reduction and how we actually start to monetize differently social issues, and to recognise how all of this, as Nick was saying there, links with the much broader issues in terms of skills, employment, just the cost to industry alone of social isolation and loneliness in terms of absences and lost work productivity is thought to be in excess of £2.5 billion. So these are issues that are fundamental to the economy and to recovery, and that's something the government really needs to take to its heart.
Some real food for thought there. So thank you both of you very much for appearing on the podcast today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.